I thank y'all for coming this morning. We've heard a whole lot this week about life and living, how to be better wives, better husbands, how to deal. What are all y'all over there for? Move this direction. Yeah, I like my audience right in front of me so I can see when I lose you. Anyway, back to what I was saying. We have heard a lot about how to live. And yet, the culture we live in, we also understand about death. Because people around us die. And there is a process that we need to go through in dealing with that death. You know, I've been married to that woman back and back for 43 years, and I really cannot imagine life without her. You know, my grandparents were married over 60 years before the first one of them died. And when you've been that closely related, it's just really difficult to think about going on without them. And yet, we have to. We have no choice. I'm going to speak to you today a little bit about two deaths that occurred in my family. This has been kind of a rough year for us. Starting in December, we lost our youngest son. In February, I lost my mother. In, what was it, March or April, we lost your brother. So we have attended a lot of funerals this year, and we're just, I know a lot more about funerals now than I ever wanted to. So basically what I'm going to try to tell you about today is how we handle these different situations. We had a little input into her brother's funeral, but we were there for it, and it is an example of going the other way from where I went with my mother and son. You know, funerals can be a major, major expense. Funeral directors, they catch you at the very worst moment of your life. And then they play on your feelings and they say, oh, your loved one would want this $10,000 casket. He's going to lay in that casket for a day or two while he's viewed. You're going to bury this in the ground. And who will see it after that? So we have to be careful about trying to prepare some in advance, so that we're not caught off guard by funeral directors and the people who say, oh, you just have to provide the very best. Because it's not a biblical description of how to bury people. You know, there is a mourning period. It says that Abraham mourned Sarah. But then he buried her, and buried is kind of a loose term. He would have put her in the cave on a hewn-out shelf, and she would have been allowed to deteriorate in a natural manner. And then sometime later, he would have come in, gathered her bones, and they would have been put into a box of some sort for safekeeping. And then when he died, his bones would have gone through that same process. All the patriarchs, as they came back, they were taken into that same cave and they were allowed to deteriorate. I had a friend who was an undertaker, and he would tell me that for some reason a body needed to be exhumed that had been embalmed, and he said they may have been in the ground 10 years, but you dig them up and they look just pretty much like how they went in the ground. He said there might be a little bit of mold on them somewhere, but you could scrape that off and they were just embalmed. And embalming is not a biblical process. It was practiced in Egypt because we know they embalmed Jacob's body, but he was going to go back to the land. So there might be cases where embalming would be considered okay, but as a general rule, it's not. I want you to think back to how funerals used to be, say, 100 years ago. People died at home under the care of the family, and when they died, they would be laid out in the living room, and all the friends and most of the family lived somewhat nearby. They would come by and pay their respects, and then the family went out and dug the grave. Well, we had a guy come out and dig the grave with the backhoe, and I liked that a lot better than the idea of the shovel work. I'm not a big fan of shovels. So we can do things on a modern basis and still keep to what we see as a biblical way of doing things. If you've seen the Israelis and the Arabs, when one of their people dies, they make great lamentations over them, but within normally 24 hours, they have taken them out, gotten them in the grave. I've been having computer trouble all morning, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. I'll just deal with it. I'm going to start out by talking about our son. Or let's go back to Adam for a minute. When Adam was walking in the garden with Yahweh, and he's receiving instructions, and Yahweh says, if you eat the fruit of that tree right there, the tree of good and evil, you are going to die. The day you eat it, you will die. Well, Eve ate it. Adam ate it. And at the end of the day, they didn't die. But we also understand that a day with Yahweh is 1,000 years. So before they reached 1,000 years old, they did truly die. Now, Adam had been created into a perfect world. What did he understand about death? He had never seen death, as far as I can tell. This is the new world. The trees are still full of fresh fruit. He's never even seen a fruit fall off a tree and rot on the ground. And yet, after they ate of the tree and they were cast out of the garden, he did learn about death. He learned that anger within the family and envy can cause one child to rise against another. So he saw one of his children killed by another one of his children. And as he went along, he saw more people born and there were deaths involved in there, and so he grew to understand death. Now, we live in a death culture. We have always lived there. You know, when I was young, when somebody died in the family, we went to the funeral. And there's a trend nowadays not to expose young children to a funeral because, oh, they won't understand death. Well, they don't understand it, sure enough, unless you take them and teach them about it. You know, they don't know where Grandma went. You know, she was here, and now she's gone, and they don't understand the process. But that's just another phase of us teaching our children. We have to teach them actually how we want to be buried. Because it should be that children bury their parents, not the other way around. But there are things that happen, and in December of last year, our son was living at our house in an apartment above my shop, and he had looked like he was getting his life together. He had been in jail. He had come out, and it was, after you've been in jail, there's this reorient period when you go from, any of you guys been in the Army, you understand, somebody telling you what to do and when to do it and where to be. Well, prison is like that. So when they come out and they make their own decisions, there's a sense of, what do I do now? He had a daughter and a stepdaughter there in town. And basically all they wanted from him was whatever he could provide for them. And he didn't always have a job. Ex-cons have problems getting jobs. But he had seemed to straighten his life around. He had started going to a computer school. And although I was not officially pleased with the school he chose, he was at least making that effort. He was riding to school with a boy who came by and got him every morning. And they would ride to school, and he'd bring him home. And so we knew that the guy had come, and then we knew he left. It was later in the morning that Fabian told us that Wayne had not gone to school. And then we see this truck pull back in, and we really thought that Wayne had gone to school and he was bringing him home. But he had just come by to give him a homework assignment. And when he went up to Wayne's apartment, Donna was in hot pursuit to see why Wayne had not gone to school. You know, a mother's intuition, if you will. And so I wasn't too far behind. I wanted to know what was going on. So I had just about got to the shop when I heard Donna holler. And so I went upstairs and found my son. And he is there. He had a bed and a chair right beside each other. It looked like he had tried to get up. And he had one arm in the chair, and he was laying catty-cornered across the bed. We know he was alive at 10:30. And we know that he was dead shortly after 12. Now, when he died in that period, I do not know. I know when I got up to the room, he was laying face down. I wanted to turn him over. And he was a big, hefty lad. And he was already stiff enough that the way he was laying, I couldn't turn him over. So, I mean, it's evident he's dead. He's cold and he's stiff. And so, we called the authorities, and they came out. Now, Wayne's 42 years old. He's in reasonably good health, as far as we knew. And he, you know, he was just a big, strong boy. So when the sheriff gets there, since we live out in the country, they actually treated his room like a crime scene. Because being young, he shouldn't have died. So they're looking for whatever might have caused it. Wayne, as far as I know, never took drugs. He drank a little alcohol, but not to excess. You know, the thing about Wayne was he was hard-headed. Since he had been a prisoner, he qualified for Medicaid. He had high blood pressure, so he could get his medicine through there. But he would only take that medicine sporadically. And me and Donna told him over and over and over, you know, this is nothing to mess with. So, of course, since it's been investigated, they sent him off to Dallas for a autopsy. And that just drug on and on and on. It was like 10 weeks before I got an official death certificate. In the meantime, to carry on some of the stuff that needed to be done, I'd gone to the county judge, and she had given me a temporary death certificate because she had called and talked to people up there, and they said, we don't know when the test results come in. So she issued this temporary death certificate so that we could take care of Wayne's business. And he was up in Dallas for a long time, and then we knew he was going to come home, and there's a place in Waco that handles dead bodies for police. And so that's where he was coming back to. In the meantime, I don't believe in cremation, so we were talking about where are we going to bury Wayne. And I called my brother-in-law, who's a woodworker, and I said, I need a casket. I need a coffin. Coffin like this, yeah. There's a difference between a casket and a coffin. A coffin is what you see in the Old West, narrow at the feet, spreads out and comes back together. A casket is just a straight, kind of squared. I didn't know that until I started into all this. So anyway, I had my brother-in-law build me a casket for Wayne. And one of the things that we had done just before he left, it took three of us and our forklift to get him out of his apartment to the guys from funeral home. Well, they're not a funeral home. They belong to this organization that takes bodies for the police. And we got him down to the ground, and I really need to measure him across shoulders because I knew I had given my brother-in-law dimensions for my mother's casket or coffin. And I knew that Wayne was much wider in the shoulder. So we got him down to the ground, and I needed to measure him. So I zipped open his the body bag, And I measured him across here, and Donna came up and laid her hands on his head. And the sheriff got all irate. No, don't be touching the body. You know, because they're still looking at this as a crime scene. So, anyway, they hauled him away and took him on to Dallas. And we didn't hear anything. Nobody seemed to know anything. Sheriffs, you know, they had sent in their reports. But finally, after 10 weeks, we get the body back. And I've got the casket ready. In the meantime, 10 days. It was 10 weeks getting the death certificate. In 10 days, they sent back the body to Waco. And I had the casket ready, and we had already gone in search of a cemetery. You know, and you think, well, cemetery, that's some place you bury people. But in the state of Texas, and the things I'm going to tell you about apply to the state of Texas. They may be the same or different in any state you live in, but they're fairly easy to find the rules of death in your state. Just you take some time at your computer and you can find out what is absolutely required by the state. And I found that the state of Texas has nearly no requirements about burying people. That most of the requirements that get put on us are put on by the cemeteries. So we wanted we got a casket that, or a coffin that's going to decompose. And we don't want to put him in a concrete crypt, because that defeats the whole purpose of what we're trying to do. So we found a cemetery right there. Actually, it's in the town that we live in, that area. And I went out and talked to the guy, and I said, now, I'm not going to embalm these people that we bury here. Is that okay? He says, it's okay with us. And I said, you don't require any concrete crypt. No, we don't. So I said, okay, if we bury a body at 6 feet, can we come back and bury one on top of it? He said, sure, doesn't matter to us. So I found this cemetery that's real cooperative with the ideas I have. And in my research, I found a cemetery in Austin that they will not bury you there if you are embalmed. If you are embalmed, you cannot be buried there. Their spaces are not these long rows. They take into consideration trees, and the burial sites are just kind of scattered, and their tombstones have to lay flat on top of the ground so they can mow over them. So we finally got Wayne, got his body back to Waco, and I took the casket, and we went down and picked up the body, and we screwed the lid down and slid it into the back of my truck and went out to the house, and there was probably 20 cars, the assorted people. So we went over to the cemetery, and we'd had a man open the grave. And he happened to also, you know, I'd figured we'd just get some pieces of rope and let the coffin into the ground. Well, he had one of these things that actually lets it into the ground. And he had it set up, so it worked out fine. And, you know, we did a, he also had a tent. And we did a service out there for him. Some of my family were there, and this is the first time I've ever been able to really sit down and tell them my beliefs in what comes after you die. And my aunt, she is solid Baptist, nailed to the floor with both feet, you know. She came up to me after the funeral and said, that was a really good message. So then we went on back to the house, and it was the traditional stuff. Friends and family had brought in food, and we had time to fellowship and talk about Wayne. You know, you're always trying to pick out the good things when the funeral's over. But he had his faults too. He was not a believer, and that's always been a distressing fact for me and his mother. But we can't force him to be a believer. Now, we could demand certain things. Since he's living on our place, he couldn't work on Sabbath. But, you know, we tried to lead him, but he was just one of these people who had no interest in religion, anybody's religion. So we we got him buried, and life goes on, you know. I don't know how many times Donna and I have thought, well, we need to tell Wayne this, or we need to ask Wayne to do something, or, you know, he was just an integral part of our life, and now he's gone. So, since we know that there's another resurrection, we're not mourning in the sense that he is lost. We're just mourning that this is our child, we loved him, and now he's gone, he's buried. So we had about recovered from that kind of a mindset. My mother had had Alzheimer's. She'd been in a nursing home for 10 years. She didn't know any of her kids. The other kids had kind of left her. So it fell to Donna and I, and mostly to Donna, to go see about her. Donna didn't like the way the nursing home washed her clothes, so she'd get her clothes and bring them home and wash them. And, you know, just these kind of things. When Mother was better, we would take her out of the nursing home to go shopping, or we'd bring her home for Thanksgiving. But the last time we had her at either one of those places, it terribly upset her. She had got down to her world was this very small piece. And when you got her outside her world, it agitated her. So we would go over to her place when the nursing home did the Thanksgiving dinner, and we'd have dinner with us. But we had quit trying to bring her to our house just because of the agitation that went on. We didn't take her shopping anymore. We just bought her clothes and brought them to her. And, you know, I don't know what Alzheimer's is, but I know it's a terrible disease because people get locked into their own mind. They can't express what they want to you. And she had been this way 10 years, you know. She didn't talk. She used to be an avid letter writer, and she quit that. The nursing home called us one night and said, the nurse in charge said, y'all need to come up here. You know, and immediately you think the worst. So she said, now, it's nothing serious. It just, your mother has started talking, and she's talking a blue streak. So we, and this is 10 o'clock at night, I guess, We got dressed and went on up there, and sure enough, my mother was talking. It was, since I know a lot of the people she was talking about, I knew that it wasn't a coherent story. She was mixing people together, and she was talking about her brother who had died, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. But that was her only brother. And she talked about old family members that I knew. We have a family reunion every year. So I'd met these people, and I had some idea who they were. And occasionally she'd run a ringer in on me that I had no idea who it was. But she talked about 2 hours, I guess. We were up there till about midnight. And then she just said, "I'm tired now," and went to bed. But, and she didn't do this ever again. I don't know what triggered it that night. And the staff didn't know. It was just, it became really, really important to Mother that she be able to talk, get this out. So, anyway, the staff was an Alzheimer's nursing home where they're specially trained to take care of Alzheimer's and dementia patients. We got no kick with the way they took care of Mother. My wife goes. But anyway, she would go up and get upset at the nursing home sometimes. They lost her clothes and this and that and something else. And I told her, I said, "Don't go up there and scream and holler enough, you get her kicked out." Because there was really not another place in Waco that was near the quality of this one. So, it was evident she was kind of going downhill. And we had hostess come in. And, you know, they've got an independent source of money. So she's been in one of these wheelchairs that you wheel around for years. Well, Hostess got her one of those kind of layback, what do they call them, Jerry chairs. They made sure that somebody official, like a nurse, came by every day and checked on her health. And there was a doctor over this whole facility. That belongs to Hostess. He's not employed by the facility. So we see that she's in good hands. And they called me one day and said, "We're not sure what's going on with your mother." So I went up there, and it was getting on to late evening. And she was just there 1 minute and gone the next. She just folded up her tent, you know. There wasn't any trauma. It was just, this was the natural course of life. She is 94 years old. She has lived a good life to the last 10 years. And even then, she lived a good life. I mean, she was cared for, and her needs were met. But she just kind of quit breathing. Now, since Wayne had died, I had told Terry that Mother was going to die, that's my brother-in-law, and I needed her coffin. And he said, "Okay, I'll get around to it." Well, Mother died, and he had not got around to it. So the plan was that I was going to be Mother's funeral director, which is entirely legal. And if I'd had her casket or her coffin right there at the nursing home, I could have put her in that coffin, taken it out, put it in the back of my truck, and driven her home. Got a small block of dry ice and screwed the top down, and the body would have been perfectly okay. And when we notified everybody, we would have had the funeral that next day. Because, I mean, mother had outlived her family, except for me and Kenny and our daughter, our sister, Sue. There was one or two other people there. But, I mean, she had just been out of circulation. Nobody knew her. Everybody that she had known in Waco had already died away. So, I had to call a funeral home and have her put in their freezer overnight. I didn't ask for the freezer, but that's where she wound up. Terry brought the coffin up the next morning. Kenny and Sue and I went over to this funeral home, picked up my mother, and we put her in the casket. And Sue had brought a blanket that my grandmother had made, my mother's mother, and wrapped her in that, took her to the cemetery, and we had a very simple service, and we buried my mother. So we have to prepare for these things. I mean, none of us want to see our family die. But I talked to my brother-in-law again, and I said, while this is fresh in your mind, I need two more coffins. Said, I need one Wayne size, and I need one that Donald fit in. We're going to go on a buy one, get one for a penny deal. But within 3 or 4 days, he brought them up, and he pulled up to the front of the house, and he had this coffin in the back of his truck. I go, where's the other one? He said, well, we started to stack them on top of each other. And said, it occurred to us they're exactly the same shape. They're just one smaller than the other. So we put the little one inside, screwed the top down. Here we are. The coffin is standing in my barn right now. I don't plan to use it anytime soon, but we've got no guarantees. And I don't want to be caught flat-footed again. You know, the state of Texas lets us deal with our own family pretty much. Now, I can make this comment about Oklahoma, and it's true of Texas as well. If you have, let's say, 10 acres, you can actually bury your family on that land. We visited Lois Morgan up in Oklahoma, and she's got two daughters in it that are buried by this big tree right out their back door. So it, you know, they're just right there close. And we were fortunate enough to know one of these daughters, and she was a hoot. She just died way before her time. But the thing is that we prepare for a lot of things in our life. And I know my mother never wanted to talk about death. That was a taboo subject for her. She just assumed that when she died, somebody would take care of it. Well, we did. But in our own cases, I think that making preparations for our own funeral is an important part of living. You know, that my grandmother on my dad's side, She had made up this pre-planned thing. She had who the pallbearers were going to be and what songs were going to be sung, what dress she wanted to be buried in. Duh, she lives another 30 years. Her pallbearers can't hardly walk, much less carry her. You know, but the dress had been saved. It was under safekeeping, and her one of her granddaughters sang her favorite song at the funeral. So she had laid it out as best she could. But what happens a lot of times, now I've been mother's executor for 10 years, so she's had no business. What little business she had, I've taken care of. But for most of us, if we were to die today, have you left a plan where your spouse, your family knows where your money is? My mother was very secretive about money. And, you know, I've just kind of had to wait on her mail to come in the early years to find out where the money was. And there wasn't a lot of it, but I figured she put it in the bank, she ought to be able to get it. Probably the worst thing that happens in a death is you have all these memories and the sorrow and the things you didn't say and the things that you did say that you're sorry for, and all these emotions are running, and then all of a sudden you've got this pile of bills and paperwork, and you go, I don't know anything about this. If you're married, there should be a partnership sharing of, you know, once a month have a meeting and say, okay, this is income, this is where all the money went, and this is how much short we came up this month. But there should be a plan. You know, if you've got insurance, that should be written down so that they know where to go. Otherwise, if you don't claim whatever insurance you got, the insurance company gets it, unless you can finally figure out where it is. But, you know, we went to Donna's brother's funeral, and it wasn't the most expensive funeral he could have had, but it was fairly elaborate. I'd say they probably spent $10,000 on his casket and stuff. You know, and he wasn't a believer either. He was embalmed, and he was buried in this really fancy box. But we bury millions and millions of dollars worth of resources every year. Metals, silks. And the person in the casket, they don't know. I mean, they don't know you put their head on a little silk pillow or that you just wrapped them in a blanket. And, you know, I understand that we want to give the illusion that we know that they're going to rise again, and we want them to sleep in comfort until then. But there are people who die without hope. I mean, they don't understand what we understand, that there is going to be a resurrection. But it is going to happen in its own phase. that we're not just all going to jump up together, but there is an orderly progression to resurrection. And personally, I think, now there's none in my family are believers except my brother. But I think when the time comes, I'm going to be able to go back to my dad's grave, my mother's grave, and they be resurrected. And I knew both of these. I had a good relationship with both of them most of the time. But I'm going to be able to explain to them that this is a new world. The things I had told you about the law are the way this world operates. And how long is it going to take to convince them? A month? A year? Who knows? But from there, we could go back to my dad's parents and my mother's parents. I knew both of them. I was 27 years old before I lost my first grandparent. So I had a good relationship with them. And we've had some religious discussions over the years, but they saw things one way and I saw them another. But I feel sure that one of my grandmothers, I can explain to her, and she's just going to say, oh, I didn't understand that. Some of my others, they need a little more work. So this is, as I see it, and I could be dead wrong about this. I mean, I don't have any special insight. But this would seem to be a logical way to progress. From my grandparents, we go back to their parents. I knew my great-grandparents on my mother's side. I was, I guess, 12 or 13 before either one of them died. So I've got some connections back that far. But as we go back, all of a sudden we're going to find families are coming together. Believers are beginning to group together, and we're going to push our way all the way back to Adam. You know, and Adam should know better than anybody who will ever be resurrected what it was like to be in the garden. And that's where Yahweh wants us. He wants to take us back to that garden. He wants to come in the cool of the evening and talk to us face to face. We're his children. We're his creation, but he created us to be his children. He's been lonely. And we're going to be his family. I will open the floor to questions if you've got any.